Redacted Media and Ghosthead.net present The Film Illogical Society. On today's episode, we continue our countdown of the BBC's 100 Greatest Comedies of All Time. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Scholes and Chad Halverson.
And welcome to another podisode of...
Trademark that, a podisode.
I should. Of the Film Illogical Society, where we only do podisodes. Only.
Yeah,
we are... Thank you. Yeah, this is being recorded in front of a live studio audience. So...
I'm going to click a button. Yeah.
Exactly.
Laugh track.
We're doing the countdown show today, where we are counting down the top 100 comedies of all time. So the laugh track is very fitting. And we are doing, this is going to be all the way number 71 on our list of 100, The Royal Tenenbaums, directed by Wes Anderson. And this film came out in 2001, so one of our more modern films, I would say.
Yeah, considering we've watched a lot of older stuff.
Yeah, we had a good run of old stuff there. With me, as always, for the countdown show is
Chad L. Halverson.
The L stands for Larry.
It does. It really does.
So the Royal Tenenbaums. So we've had Wes Anderson on before.
Oh yeah, because we did Rushmore.
Yep, Rushmore,
right?
Was on the list. So, we'll get into some depth into the characters and the actors that were in this, because this, unlike the last couple movies that we've seen, has a very strong and deep cast.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very large cast of characters and great actors.
But he always does that, especially once he got, you know, more popular and better.
Oh yeah.
Not that he was ever bad. Like, that's his specialty. He's like a Tarantino film, you know? Like, when you go into a Tarantino film, you know you're going to go into, like, this huge cast of, like, oh, wow, I haven't seen that guy since that show from the 70s.
Well...
But, like, Wes Anderson's a little different, where I think he found his crop early, and then he stuck with it. He's one of those directors.
Well, he was college friends with Owen Wilson.
Yes.
So they were roommates or whatever, and they Owen Wilson obviously brought in his brother Luke into the fold, and I'm sure that Owen Wilson also had a hand in bringing Ben Stiller into this film.
What?
Yeah, maybe. So let's. Well, first, Chad, how are you doing?
I mean, to be honest, it's been a rough day, but I feel like I'm doing better now that you're here.
Oh, thank you. Wait, we're talking about me or the live audience?
The live audience.
Okay. Well,
it's a crowd of thousands.
Well, hundreds if not thousands.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about some of these actors now.
Okay. I like, if you pull up the Wikipedia page, they actually have, like, a diagram of who's related to who.
It is a very complicated cast in some ways. So let's start up on top. So, Royal Tenenbaum, the main character, is played by, one of the best Lex Luthor, but he's been in so many things. Gene Hackman, who is essentially retired from acting now. This was one of his last films.
Oh, well, was? Really?
Yeah, it was one of his last five films. He was in a couple other films after it, but this was his last bit. He's essentially retired. He's retired from acting.
Oh, yeah.
Now, so, but, a very difficult actor to work with, apparently.
Yeah.
He's very serious, very, no bullshit around him or anything like that. So much so that some of the other actors in Wes Anderson's crew, namely Bill Murray, felt they needed to be on set even on days they weren't working just to help, like, mitigate Gene Hackman and protect Wes Anderson. Have you...
Wes...
Yeah, protect Wes Anderson from Gene Hackman. Have you you heard of that before? Like of...
No.
I've heard of, like, actors kind of, you know, especially difficult directors kind of, like, working with each other to say, like, hey, you know, just have to treat him like this or this is how he does things. But I've not heard that with many actors who are difficult or can get really snippy or angry quickly. That a director needs protecting.
I mean, maybe... I mean, it was later in Hackman's career. I mean, it was right before he retired, but... It's... I give a little credit to Bill Murray, if that's true. And was it just him, or did, like, other actors, would they come in to kind of, like, be like, hey, hang out on set?
I think Bill Murray's role being a little bit smaller in this one, he wasn't... He could be kind of that... That loose
that
person,
buffer.
That buffer, yeah.
Because, like, Bill Murray's I'm assuming Gene Hackman, he's an accomplished actor, but sometimes the really good ones can get inside their own head. Bill Murray seems to straddle that line. Like, he's not full of himself because he's very self-deprecating, but he probably knows what it feels like to be the best actor in the room. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, and, you know, and I think, too, that so Bill Murray... And Wes Anderson developed a relationship on Rushmore.
Yes.
The Royal Tenenbaums was Wes Anderson's third feature film.
This is Bottle Rocket.
Bottle Rocket, Rushmore,
and
then Royal Tenenbaums.
This was his third, yep. Yeah.
So it's probably a big step up for him, director-wise, going from the cast of mostly people that he knew or, you know, had surrounded himself with before in with Rushmore, to now bringing in some pretty heavy hitters.
Even Alec Baldwin.
Baldwin as the narrator.
Danny Glover.
Angelica Houston.
Gwyneth Paltrow. I mean, she was still out to prove herself at that time, but, like, 2001, that was Paltrow in her prime.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I can see why Bill Murray thought we need to help him. We need to help Wes Anderson because we don't want him to kind of, like, just falter in front of Gene Hackman.
Yeah.
So I can see that. So, all right. So Gene Hackman with the key main role. You have Angelica Houston playing his, for most of the movie, his wife.
It's wife,
separated,
yeah.
Wife.
Just separated.
And she kind of plays,
she made sure the kids
were
taken care of and,
yeah,
like, got educated.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think she took care of their emotional needs, which we'll get into.
Obviously not.
But she made sure that they were all, their gifts were, given a place for them to grow into.
Yeah.
So she did well there. You have the three Tenenbaum kids. You have Ben Stiller as Chaz, Gwyneth Paltrow as Margot, and Luke Wilson as Richie Tenenbaum. What do you think about the three Tenenbaum children?
Okay, so I've actually never seen this movie before. It was actually
theater
when I worked. It was one of those things where I think I was too afraid to admit that I'd never seen it. because I heard it was great from everybody.
Okay. Okay. So well, I'm kind of happy.
Like once I saw it was on this list.
Yeah, I'm kind of happy that then that you've made that confession.
Yeah, you're welcome, America, yeah. And our audience.
True confession.
Yeah, like it's. I didn't really know what to expect. I remember the preview because I worked at the theater. I remember seeing the preview a million mm-hmm. times, and that opening scene where they asked if it's their fault, and he's like, "Well, no. I mean, you know, sort of." I really wasn't like. And I remember in the preview where, and I'm getting too deep into this, where he says he's dying. Like I remember all that, but it's kind of cool that yeah, they're brother and sister, and the. Wes Anderson's really good at setting up his stories. He's very, in the way he shoots.
Very meticulous.
Meticulous, but he shoots it like it's a play. Yep. Like, I mean, Rushmore, like, he had a bunch of plays in that. Like, he's obviously a fan of plays.
Yep.
And, like, that structure. That's why his, like, angles are always, you know, everything's symmetrical. Everything's, on the same plane.
Yeah, and the one thing, and we're getting into Wes Anderson now, which is fine, because he deserves to be talked about, but one, I think his cinematography is just beautiful, with the symmetry and the plane, and the way that he uses the frame, let's talk about two films now that we've seen already. Now, The Royal Tenenbaums, and compare that to The Ladies' Man. So one of the first movies that we saw, which was also felt very play-like in its doll box or dollhouse type of setup. Now, where I would say Wes Anderson is superior to Jerry Lewis, and I'm saying that because I would guess that Wes Anderson was inspired by Jerry Lewis. But where he's better than him is Jerry Lewis still felt like it was a play almost in The Ladies' Man.
Yeah.
It felt like it was a play. It was a setup. You had the room, then you move to the next room, then you move to the next room. With Wes Anderson, he knows the camera frame. So he uses that like a silent movie does where... If it's not on frame, it's the actors aren't seeing it either. So the way he moves his camera, tracking left and right, and just motivated moves with the camera, I think he's using the medium so effectively to tell his story.
Yeah, but while using like traditional
yes.
framing techniques that you would use on a stage,
absolutely,
or, like,
yeah, but using like, but making the camera more of an eye versus and less passive of an eye, I should say, a more motivated
eye. Yeah, yeah,
because obviously the camera is always the eye of the audience, but it I feel like instead of just kind of observing. Many of these films that we've seen, we're just watching. I almost feel like we're part of the film. Does that make sense?
Yeah, he has a good way of. I mean, my favorite comedy that he's done or movie that he's done is Life Aquatic of Steve Zissou, and it's not only like the way he tells the story through the frame, but like. He's funny, but like he's got a dark sense of humor,
yes.
And it's and every movie's different, but like specifically with this one, like there's the thing with Margot and Richie, and you know infidelities, and a father who never was there, not that he didn't tell the truth, but he maybe told too much of the truth, and he didn't realize how bad it was until near the end.
Yeah, it was too late.
Yeah, and
almost
and going back to the characters, like, you know, you asked me what I thought about the brother and sister. Like, I liked the dynamic, you know, of Stiller, Paltrow, and Wilson, but I also liked that they were all going through their own shit.
Yeah.
And it didn't necessarily take them all to come together to help each other. Like, Royal was trying to mend stuff with Chaz, and then Richie was always very fond of his father, but then he gets, you know, hurt in a way because his father lied to him, and Margot is juggling her own stuff. So they are siblings, and they do connect, but at the same time, it's a... And actually, I don't even see it as their story. I see it as Royal's story.
It's Royal's... Royal's obviously the main character, but...
Yeah, totally.
But everyone has a story in this. All these main characters have a story. Even some of the minor characters have a story.
And that's another Wes Anderson thing. Like, no, like, even if you're a second-tier character in his script, you're going to have somewhat of an arc.
Yep.
Bigger than... any normal filmmaker would give you. It's weird, but it works though, and I think it makes the cast always clicks better. Like, have you ever watched a Wes Anderson movie and said like, "Oh wow, all that acting was garbage," or you know, like true. It's just he's cracked his own code. He can't do everything,
but
he's definitely like created a style that's unique, and it has given it's I'm gonna compare him to Tarantino again, even though they're like completely different directors. They both have their niche.
Yeah,
and
I think that's like, a fair comparison, just because like Tarantino can't do everything either, but they have their niche. They have their crew. You know what you're getting into when you're getting into a Tarantino film. You know what you're getting into when you get into a Wes Anderson film.
Well, and I think that allows them, as their careers have gone on, to book bigger and better talent.
Yeah.
Because the talent's like, wow, I want to be a part of that because it's different than anything else I do, you know, for anybody else. So, I definitely think all these characters, like Eli has a big arc. Raleigh St. Clair, he has his like little.
We'll get into all those characters.
Oh.
I know. This is the biggest section probably today. I just remember. So I've seen this film a couple of times, but I always forget little things. So in this, you know, what I forgot this time, was how Royal always introduced his daughter. And this is my adopted daughter.
Yeah.
And just when she's like a little girl and he's doing that, I just found that like it was like cringy and funny at the same time. Just like, oh, that's not a good dad move. That's not a good dad. So then you also had I guess next door neighbor who always kind of wanted to be part of the family but never was, Eli Cash, played by Owen Wilson. And one thing I did say to my wife as we're watching this was, you know what? While their voices are very similar, Luke Wilson and Owen Wilson really don't look enough alike to like for it to be like, shouldn't those guys be the brothers?
Like if you went into this movie not knowing anything about these actors, you would never know that they were brothers in real life. Yeah, I that's the funny thing about these two, because they play opposite each other, have played opposite each other quite a few times, and it works. Like, Owen's got his own, like his own nasally way of, you know, wow. But Luke is, I don't know, not that Luke is bland, but he's more of a... He plays a straighter character.
He can play, I mean, yeah.
Owen Wilson. Not straight as, like, sexual orientation, but, like...
Like, the straight man. Like, he's the one that the comedy is played off of. I see him more as wanting to be and has the potential to be more of a serious actor, too. If he wanted to be.
Even though, like, I consider Wes Anderson movies to be... They're pretty dramatic. They're dramedies.
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying that like a lot of Owen Wilson films almost went slapstick or you know, like more lowbrow comedy. You know, where Luke Wilson did have some films that, you know, old school and things like that that are more, you know, just straight up comedies. But
Mitchapalooza.
But he's tried his hand in some more serious films, whether it be 310 to Yuma or whatever. So he's done more. But yeah, I thought Owen Wilson did well. Then you have the what we'll introduce these guys together. You had Bill Murray and Danny Glover, both who had significant roles. Bill Murray plays Raleigh St. Clair, who is Margot Tenenbaum's husband.
Yep.
For a little bit, and then Danny Glover, who early in the film proposes to Angelica Houston, who still isn't legally divorced from Royal. So that's kind of the plot. Sorry to steal your thunder.
There's so much.
That's the underlying plot of the film, though, is Royal granting his family to move on, basically.
Yes.
And then you had some, you know, with Seymour Cassell and Kumar Palana. They are standard for Wes Anderson films.
Yep.
And then, of course, the last one is Alec Baldwin, the narrator. Perfect narrator for this type of film.
Velvety voice. Smooth.
Yes. So any other characters that you would like to talk to? There are a lot of characters in this film. There are a lot of named characters that have a little bit of an arc. We didn't talk about Ari and Uzi. We didn't talk about, a lot of the other, some of the other characters that also have a little bit of a arc in them.
Yeah, even the kid, was it Dudley?
Dudley, yes.
With Raleigh St. Clair.
Yep, that has, I forget the disease that he had, but it's nothing. It's just that the kid was stupid.
It's just a stupid
kid. Yeah, he's a stupid kid, but it was his breakthrough. Like, and
when the cab drives up and it's just a piece of shit. It's got, like, half the window is cardboard, and, you know, he's like, oh, there's a dent there. Oh, there's another one there.
Yeah, and actually, that is good. We'll talk about some of those references, but we'll talk about those in a little bit. So,
you're so mean.
I know.
You're so mean.
Well, someone told me I had to keep the show moving. So, let's get into the next part. Chad talks about the plot.
That's Mario. Don't use that. We don't have Nintendo money yet.
Well,
this is gonna be a hard plot breakdown
again. If Nintendo people are listening, that means we're successful.
That's true.
Okay, I'm putting 2 minutes on the clock.
Put it for one. We'll see.
I'll give you three. I'll give you three.
3 minutes, Jesus.
3 minutes. This is a lot.
Okay.
Focus. Okay. I already gave you like the main underlying plot, at least. So,
sure.
And clock is moving.
Okay, so Royal Tenenbaum is the movie starts off with a prologue, and essentially Royal is the father of three children and a husband, and right away he sits him down. He's like, "I'm getting a divorce because pretty much I cheated on your mom." Ethelyn essentially is like, get out of my house, you're done, I'm gonna raise these kids, they're gonna be super smart. She wrote a book on it. These kids are way up ahead of their time. Chaz is like super successful, he's good with money. Richie is athletic and he becomes a tennis pro in his teens. And Margot is an artist, and she's a playwright, and they all like have their moment in the spotlight. And we cut to years later. Royal hasn't been home in years. He's technically still married to Ethelene, and the kids are all going through their own thing. Richie's on a boat in the middle of nowhere, just traveling the world. Chaz's wife died a year previous, and he's super, you can tell he's stressed out, and he's just, you know, he hasn't handled it well. And Margot is married to Raleigh St. Clair, and she's obviously depressed.
And she's also having an affair.
Yeah, she's also having an affair with Eli. So Chaz ends up freaking out, and he moves back home with his mom. Margot finds out, so she moves in, and then Richie comes home when Royal comes into the picture and says that he has cancer. Now, rewind back. The reason why Royal does this is he finds out that Henry Sherman proposed to his wife. So he's pretty much like in a pretty... He's pretty much like, I gotta put, you know, a stick in the spokes here.
1 minute.
So he moves in, he convinces everybody he has cancer, he tries, like, mending bridges, and he sort of does, but everybody finds out that he's faking it, and he gets kicked out again. He gets a job as a elevator guy, and so Richie finds out about Margot having an affair with Eli, and everything's depressed, and Richie tries to commit suicide. They get him to the hospital. He sneaks out. Him and Margot kind of, like, figure their thing out. Chaz... Oh, man. See? I can't... Oh, man. This is so much. Okay. Probably would have helped if I've seen this movie more than once. Okay. Yes. All right. I'm going to go a little bit over. So, Richie commits suicide. Him and Margot basically agree, like, you know, we love each other, and we'll just figure it out. Chaz is still pissed about his dad, and but like Royal, while all this is happening, he gets the job, and he essentially, they kicked him out because like he was a nobody and his family hated him, and rightfully so. He was a bad person, so he starts doing all the right things. He gets a job. He helps Pagoda get a job because he got him fired because Pagoda was helping him know everything that was going on between Henry and Ethelene.
He connects with his grandkids.
Yeah, he connects with his grandkids, Ari and Uzi, which is nice because the kids thought he was dead. Yeah. Like, their dad told him he was dead. So he's starting to, like, mend wounds. Like, he goes up to Ethelene and Henry. He's like, here's divorce papers. I signed them. Go ahead and sign them. They'll be done soon. You guys can get married. So we cut to the wedding day. It's at the house. And, you know, we're meeting Henry's son. And, you know, it's a party. Wes Anderson always has parties near the ends of his movies. Most of them. And Eli. I forgot to talk about Eli this whole time. So Eli is... Is he just depressed because he knows that Margot's in love with Richie?
Well, I think that, and he's also, he always wanted to be part of the wanted family.
He wanted to be a Tenenbaum. Yeah. So Eli this entire time is, like, doing drugs, and then he's, like, doing cocaine.
But he's also sending, like, newspaper clippings of his success to the Tenenbaum mom.
Well, and he was doing that before he was doing the drugs.
Right, but I'm just saying, like, just like, proof that, like, he wanted to be part of the family. That was the connection.
Like, he always... Yep, he wanted to be a part of it, and because he wasn't with Margot anymore, or at least Margot wanted nothing to do with him, you know, he starts spiraling down a hole. Richie, after he commits suicide the day after, tries to get Eli to get his shit together, but he just runs away. Eli gets invited to the wedding, and he's, like, coked up out of his mind. He's driving a car down the road super fast and crazy. And Chaz noticed that he's about to hit Ari and Uzi and their little dog. And we hear a crash. We cut back. And we're told by Richie that Chaz saved Ari Royal and Uzi. Royal. Richie tells Chaz that Royal saved Ari and Uzi. And, like, Chaz has that moment where he, like, wow, his father actually did something selfless. Like... you know, it was a moment. And then they chase down Eli, and they finally, like, convince him to get into rehab, and then the next day, Etheline and Henry get married anyways. But there was a moment where Chaz, like, finally opened up to his dad. Like, his dad bought a dog to replace a dog that was killed, like, the same day.
Yeah.
And he thanked his dad, and he's like, you know, hey, it's been a rough year. And he, you know... And his dad's like, I know. And it... The movie ends kind of where it began, where, you know, everybody's together.
Well, it started... Well, it ended... I think the family was a lot happier. Royal connected with them all again. And, you know, even the ex-wife... You know,
everybody had something to thank Royal right. for, even though everything he had done up the first, you know, 60 years of his life was awful.
Yeah.
He tried to make it right in the end. He tried to make up for lost time, and not that everything was perfect, because it's still a damaged family. It's still a messed up family, but he wanted... He went in trying to just claim his wife. Like, he was just a complete douchebag. Yep. And it took, you know, him seeing what he had done to his kids, or what the lack of a father did, or what his constant berating, or he treated each of the kids differently, too. Richie was his favorite. Chaz, you know, he kind of egged on more than he should have. And Margot, he always referred to
his adopted
daughter. So each of the kids had something different that messed them up. And he didn't realize that until he got in the middle of it. Sorry, well, seven
it's
minutes.
It's okay. This was a...
It's a Wes Anderson movie, man. It's not meant to be compacted into 1 minute. It's impossible.
When they're going to visit...
Sorry.
Royals... mother's grave, and Margot's like, well, I've never been invited before. Like, why? Well, I never thought you'd be interested since you were adopted. It's like,
oh, so
good, but so terrible.
So terrible, but so good.
So
she's the literal redheaded stepchild of the family.
So let's talk a couple of things. So I know this is the first time that you've saw this, so you brought up there's the gypsy cab before, and then there's the Green Line buses as well, both of which were big and around in the 1970s, and that was something purposefully done. So, like, and the way that the family dresses and everything is very 70s, although it's set in the modern era.
Yeah, once you get to present day, it's present day 2001. Right.
But they're still wearing fashion that was in the 70s, but that was something that Wes Anderson did.
Well, he does that in a lot of his movies too.
But this was to represent. So the 70s were when this family were at their highest peak. Right, like everyone was achieving success in the 70s. And everyone was still trying to hold on to that. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just an interesting take on it. Because, you know, bringing in Gypsy Cab Company, bringing in the Green Line Bus Company, like, those are things that don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I don't know. I part of his visual style, Wes Anderson's, is... And we keep saying Wes Anderson, but, like, really we mean we're encompassing, like, his art department, his director of photography, like, the people he surrounds himself with. Because it's not just, like, Wes has these ideas in his head, but it takes a whole team to, like, get this together. But saying that, he has just, like, a really good way of picking whatever art style he's going to go with and, like, committing to it. In every frame, like there's never a moment where they're not wearing 70s clothes, right. Or like their house isn't decorated like you know, they were there in the 70s. It's,
I mean, even the cigarettes, the brand of cigarettes that Margot smokes.
The brand of cigarettes, they're filterless, too.
Yeah, and they were only sold in Ireland and discontinued in the 1970s. So that's how specific, like to this era that Wes Anderson was getting it to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's yeah. One of the actors that was approached before Gene Hackman, although Gene Hackman was, Wes Anderson said he wrote the role of Royal Tenenbaum thinking of Gene Hackman. That's who he wanted to play it. But one actor that turned down that role was Gene Wilder. How different of a film do you think it would be with Gene Wilder in that role?
Let me see. No, Margot, you get nothing! Yeah, it would have been weird. I you know what? I never like doing hypotheticals like that. Only because that's... It's not like you're taking one grip out and replacing it with another grip. Like, you're literally taking an actor replacing somebody that, yes, can act, and they are an actor, but they do it so differently. Yeah. I don't know. Like, Gene Hackman, I feel, nailed it. If he was a pain in the ass to work with, I thought it was worth it.
Yeah, I mean, he you truly feel what I think the kids and the wife felt as far as, like, you know, how you reacted towards his portrayal of the character. How about this decision making? Danny Glover, Luke Wilson, and Owen Wilson all turned down roles in Ocean's 11 because of this film. Good really? Choice, bad choice.
Good choice, because Bros before Ocean's 11. Because if Owen Wilson was...
I see the Wilson brothers doing that every time. Danny Glover's more of a surprise.
I don't know. That's later in his career, and... I'm assuming he would have played Cedric Entertainers.
No idea. Cedric, he could have played one of the older...
Anybody,
yeah.
Okay.
Brad Pitt. He would have been Brad Pitt's role.
He would have been Brad Pitt. That would have been... Actually, he would have nailed that.
Oh, yeah. Danny Glover.
But, like, I mean, I think at this point, Wes Anderson kind of had a name for himself. And,
well, again, this is his third film.
I'm speculating.
Third film.
Yeah.
You know, Rushmore did very well. But it was still an indie film.
Still, but, like, it's such a stellar cast. And, like, Danny Glover seems like, especially later in his career after, you know, all the Naked Gun movies. Not Naked Gun. That's what we just
Lethal
watched.
Weapon.
Lethal Weapon movies. You know, I think he earned the right to pick and choose what he wanted to do. And, I don't know. This is something different. I can't speak for Danny Glover, I would assume that's why he did it. And I would say Owen Wilson and Luke Wilson did it because they're bros with Wes Anderson. They're like,
yeah, they're going to do that.
Fuck Danny Ocean.
Well, I mean, you know, Ocean's 11 with George Clooney, Brad Pitt, you know it's going to be a big film. You know, kudos to those actors for doing it. I do think that... as far as what movie is going to have more legs in the future, like, it's hard to predict, like, 50 years from now, what movies are people going to be watching from this era. But so in your opinion, what film do you think 50 years from now people will watch more? Ocean's 11 or The Royal Tenenbaums?
That's... Because I would like to make the argument that Ocean's 11 doesn't have enough staying power to last that long, but, like, it's a popular heist film. It's a good film. Like, it's not bad. I've seen it a million times because my roommate used to fall asleep to it every night. That and Pirates of the Caribbean and Big Trouble in Little China. Those are the three movies I fell asleep to for, like, 4 years. Ugh. Anyways, what were we talking about?
Which film 50 years from now will be watched more?
I feel like I feel like if it's a film school setting or if it's snooty filmmakers, it's going to be Wes Anderson all the way. Wes Anderson's never going to go away. He's not for everybody. But I definitely think, like, Ocean's 11 made a lot of money. A lot of people saw that. And it's in the zeitgeist. At least it still sort of is. I don't know. That's so hard. Just think about that. Like, we're at a point now where we already have, what, like, 90 years, 100 years of film catalogs to go through. Imagine being now 50 years in the future to not only have to catch up with all the stuff that we didn't grow up with and all the stuff that's coming out now, but now you got to get, like, all the stuff from what's going to be from here and now. I know I'm, like, going, whoa, fucking, but, like, that's just... But think about the amount of media we have now, too, versus, you know, back in the day where, you know, silent films, and then we get talkies, and then TV happens, now TV and film, and... Chris, that's just... What I'm trying to say is that is just a question too great for one man to answer.
Well, I am putting a poll out there on the Filmological Society. Feel free to share it. Asking that question, which film will be watched more 50 years from now? Ocean's 11, the 2001 version, or the Royal Tenenbaums? I think it's a good question.
I only think, because, like, what movies do we really remember from back in the day? Yes, there are, like, really good, there weren't independent movies way, way back in the day. But you know what I mean?
Small studios.
Like, the big studio stuff, I feel like, has more legs only because it's big studio stuff. Like, they're going to have that catalog pushing it into people's faces for the next 50 years. You know, I'm sure they're going to reboot Ocean's 11 three times between... Well, they already did. I didn't even see the new one.
Well,
but,
yeah.
Like, I'm sure they're going to reboot it another two times between now and 50 years from
Probably,
now.
Yeah. You know, because I think that's the problem is with those type of films, you have to update technology, you have to update what's going on.
But people like that story.
They like heist films,
People like a heist film. That's why the new Avengers was so good.
All right. So the last little note I'm going to give, and we can talk a little bit more, because the other topics are, like, the music, once again... Wes Anderson just
crushed it.
Just perfect music. Every song is perfect. He always has a Rolling Stones song in his movie, and he had two of them, and they both were at perfect times. But just absolutely perfect music.
The score, too. Oh, yeah. There was a soundtrack, and the score was really good, too. Anyways.
The Hawk... So Richie, outside of playing Mordecai. So if you noticed, the hawk that was in the beginning of the film and the hawk at the end of the film looked very different.
Yes.
That is because the hawk in the beginning of the film was hawknapped during the shooting and held for ransom by somebody.
What?
Yes. So they had to find another trained hawk to do, because they couldn't wait. They weren't going to pay the ransom, and they couldn't wait. So they wrote into the film that, oh, the hawk must have gone through some bad things, because look at the white feathers now and stuff like that. Like,
I mean, it works.
It works, absolutely. But yeah, the original hawk was hawknapped.
I know we've gone off track a lot tonight, okay. But can I just bring up, imagine being Wes Anderson, a director of your third major motion picture, and now you're in a hostage negotiation for a hawk.
Yes.
Like, and I could see why they didn't pay the ransom. I'd be like, no, that's fucking dumb. Like, fuck you. But still, like, if I was ever in that position, you know, my entire career I wanted to be a filmmaker, and now I'm here and I'm doing it, and all of a sudden now I have to hostage negotiate a predatory bird,
right.
Like, where did my life go wrong?
Well, where did your life go wrong that you thought, oh, I'll kidnap a hawk
No.
This
kidding.
Is a good idea. I'll put an animal that eats other creatures.
Although they were shooting in New York, so I mean there are plenty of crazy things that happen there. So I guess I'm not that surprised.
All right.
But I am surprised. That's a crazy story.
All right, so this is the first time you saw this film.
See.
Would you watch it again?
Hell yeah. Only because I, from all the other Wes Anderson films I've watched, like, you need multiple viewings. He does this thing, and trying to think of... The Ballad of Buster Scruggs kind of did the same thing, if you've seen it. But, he does a lot of, like, he'll use books or photos, or, like, he'll shoot straight down on a desk and you'll see certain things popped out and he'll label them. Like, those scenes go by so fast. It definitely takes another viewing. Plus, the way he writes, it's very layered. And he's a very dry person. I love dry humor, but dry humor is a little hard to keep up with sometimes. So I like going back to, like Monty Python. It's one of my favorite things ever that has ever graced this world. But it took multiple viewings for me to get, like, most of those jokes as an adult.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Wes Anderson is the same thing for me. Like, I would definitely watch this again.
Good. Yeah, I would. This is one of my favorite films. I think...
On this list or of all time?
Of Wes Anderson films. Like, if I'm looking at Wes Anderson films, I like The Life Aquatic a lot. I like Rushmore, Royal Tenenbaums, and The Grand Budapest Hotel are probably my two favorites.
I still have to see Budapest.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, Moonrise Kingdom is good. Fantastic Mr. Fox is good. Darjeeling Unlimited. I mean, he's got a very strong list of films that he's written and directed.
And, like, either if they were commercial success or not, they're all, like, good. Yeah. I haven't seen all of them, but, like, I trust most of the people that I work with, and none of them would, you know, none of them are going to be that hardcore about, like, oh, I love this director, so I'm going to like it no matter what. Like, I work with a lot of discerning people, and I know they would tell me if a movie sucked. And Wes Anderson is one of those guys where he's just been consistently good. Now, I think you can attribute that to him just kind of like, he doesn't copy himself, but again, he has a niche, mm-hmm. and it works for him, but he's used it in different ways and he's told different stories. And I think it's also because they're not just comedies. Like, I feel like if he had like the same look, now granted this one worked for a comedy, but the way he's boxed himself in, it gives him the perfect lens to tell these really detailed dramatic stories in a humorous way that we really wouldn't necessarily think about or, it's taboo. Yeah. Like, it's slightly taboo.
But he's also one, if you look at his filmography, he also does a lot of short films. And I think he does a lot of short films. Some of them are promotional films. Like, he'll make, he'll find like a small story or a character in one of his films and make a short film about them. But also just to try things and to do things and to tell a story in a different way. Sometimes they're expanded into full films and sometimes they're not. So it's you know, or sometimes they tell a different story about the same character. With the Darjeeling Limited, you have Hotel Chevalier, I believe that's how it's pronounced, with Natalie Portman and Jason Schwartzman that opened up for that film. It's a short film, but it's the same character. Jason Schwartzman's playing the same character in that film as he does in Darjeeling Limited, I should say. So it's a way to get to know those characters a little bit more. Yeah, it's when Wes Anderson has a new film come out, I'm intrigued. I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna want to see that.
And that's very rare, because, like, I know some people would argue, like, every Steven Spielberg movie I go see, I'm like, no.
He's had a lot of films that just weren't great.
no. Like, I'm not excited about the remake of...
West Side Story?
West Side Story. Like, why? If Spielberg, if you're going to do it, try to make it different. Don't just, like, put us back in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And recast it. Yeah. Like, shit, I'll go to the actual show if I want to see that.
Yeah. Don't humor me. Take that, Steven Spielberg.
But my point is, like, Wes Anderson hasn't made as many movies as Spielberg, so his batting average could be slightly elevated because he's pitching and he's not, like, a fielder or anything. But he's consistently good. Like, I would have to research this, but I would bet that, like, his meta rating has never gone below, like, 65, 60.
Yeah, I would think that they would all be fairly high. You know, again, I don't necessarily think that Wes Anderson is going to attract a wide audience. I don't think he's ever...
No.
At least at his current trajectory, I don't think he's ever going to have the top grossing film in any given year.
He's never going to be hired to do a Marvel movie.
No, I think he is someone who could win an Oscar. I think he should have.
Absolutely.
I think he should have. Maybe for the Grand Budapest Hotel or some of these other more complicated stories he's telling. But, you know, he still has time. So we'll see. If he keeps doing it, we'll keep watching it. So any final thoughts as we wrap up this episode on the Royal Tenenbaums?
Ugh, man, do we have any more Wes Anderson movies?
I don't believe so, which is why I went into a deep dive on him.
That's sad, because I'm still upset that Life Aquatic isn't on this list. But whatever, not everybody can be as cool as me. No, I'm definitely gonna watch this again. It's a good movie. Like, it's complicated and it's sad and it's real and, like, he. It is a comedy, but there's a lot of real life in it. Like when, man, Owen Wilson or Luke Wilson, when Richie shows his scars to Margot.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's makeup and it's, you know, other shit, but, like, you know, that stuff's real. And, but then again, they didn't show the car getting hit by a dog.
Right.
Or the dog getting hit by
that
a car.
That either, yeah.
So it's, yeah, thanks. But it's, I don't know, he's one of a kind, definitely. He will definitely be relevant in 50 years. I just don't think, again, because he's not bred for that wide of an audience, I don't think he's going to be, this is going to be watched as much as Ocean's 11 would. But it doesn't matter. Like, it's not about the views, the clicks, the likes, and all that shit. It's like, is it good? Yes, great.
What?
The views will come. Yeah. If it's good enough, people will watch
it. And I think the one telling thing, though, is Ocean's 11 will be remade. It's been remade. It's been made three times now with two or three offshoots of it. I don't see the Royal Tenenbaums are going to get remade ever. Like,
I was going to say.
No one's going to sit down and say, let's redo this film.
Okay. Do you think any Wes Anderson film would be remade?
That's a good question.
Like, if there was one that could possibly be remade, which one would it be?
Maybe Isle of Dogs?
Okay. Are you joking?
No, I think Isle of Dogs or Fantastic Mr. Fox, like, those are both stop-motion animation.
It's a dumb question. I was just... curious.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's it'd be tough because why, you know, the director style in these cases are as important as the story, you know,
exactly.
Where like Ocean's 11, it's styled to what is considered hip and cool, and at the time. You know, at the time of the film, so like the original Ocean's 11, if you watch it now, it's like holy shit, this is a terrible film. But the one made in 2001, George Clooney, Brad Pitt, very cool, very hip film, Vegas. You know, it's a very different feel. 50 years from now, when they remake Ocean's 11 again, Vegas is going to be on a totally different level as far as what is considered cool, what's considered hip. This,
I know it's hip to be square.
Well, it was in the 80s.
What is it now?
Parallelogram.
Gotcha. Yeah,
it's very different. But yeah, I don't see, because I think someone has to really, if you take a Wes Anderson film, you would have, and if you wanted to redo it, you would have to like just completely
essentially have to clone Wes Anderson before he died.
Either that, or just take the story and just completely put a completely different style on it. Like I don't see this film, these films ever being redone.
Me neither.
But again, Fantastic Mr. Fox. You know, if like a Disney treatment is done to them, where they use computer animation to make it now instead of stop motion or hand drawn cartoon, maybe. But the other ones, yeah, I don't see that. Because it's not only the style and the writing, but also the actors who are playing the roles. You know, they become characters themselves. So, yeah. Yeah, that's a good question, though. I was like, yeah, I don't see this ever being remade.
Good, because for all the reasons you just said, it would be awful. Okay.
So we'll talk about that project then after this, about
Yeah. Let's have our secret takeover Wes Anderson meeting. Yeah,
redo Rushmore.
Hashtag redo Rushmore.
All right, so good. That was a good episode. So our next one, film number 70.
Oh, man.
Can you believe it?
Wow.
And it is a film called In the Loop. Have you ever heard of it?
I have seen probably the first half hour of this movie. I never finished it. The last Doctor Who.
Yep, Peter Capaldi.
Peter Capaldi. He's in it, and he swears all the time. And this is also, it's based off of a British TV show. I do know that. And did I say James Gandolfini was in it?
He didn't, but he is.
Yep. He is. And I can understand probably why it's on this list, because it's a very British movie. And I haven't even finished it, but I can't wait to watch it. Yep. So I'm excited. So
In the Loop is our next film. It's from 2009. I have not seen this before. I actually have not heard of it before this list. So
I'm pretty sure it's a political satire comedy.
All right.
So perfect for us.
Right. Nothing but satire right now for us. Any other final thoughts?
Chris, who does God love?
Well, Lord loves a working man.
Damn it!
Don't trust Whitey.
Damn it.
See a doctor and get rid of it. Thank you, everybody.
The Filmological Society is a production of Redacted Media in association with Ghost Hat Media. For more information, find us on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, or visit us at www.ghosthat.net.